Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening and want to get you thinking right off the bat. Which group are you in? The 1% who will own more than half of everything by next year or everyone else? I'm sure you heard that statistic. Here's a harder one. Are you in the group of families in poverty who send more than half of all students to public school, or in the group of everybody else? Finally, are you among the relatively few families in the U.S. who got paid leave for taking care of a new baby, time off for a working mom or a working dad? Or are you among the larger group of everyone else? If you can answer any of those questions, that will surely come up in the President's State of the Union address later today. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, tweet it out at thetakeaway.org, or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Lots more this hour, including a possible regime change going on in Yemen. But let's begin with the reported plan of President Obama to significantly extend on a social benefit offered to American families by President Bill Clinton back in 1993.
Now millions of our people will no longer have to choose between their jobs and their families. The law guarantees the right of up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave per year when it's urgently needed at home to care for a newborn child or an ill family member. This bill will strengthen our families, and I believe it will strengthen our businesses and our economy as well.
That's President Clinton signing the Family and Medical Leave Act, which said you can't lose your job for taking family-related days off. President Obama wants to ensure that those days off will come with pay, joining a policy common to much of the industrialized world. Betsy Stevenson is one of the architects of President Obama's parental leave plan. She's a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors and a professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan. Welcome, Betsy.
Hi, John. How are you?
Great. Let's talk a little bit about the details of this program to be outlined tonight. What do you think American consumers who maybe are into their third month of pregnancy and looking at their family leave situation sometime this year, what details stand out?
Well, what the president is calling for, first of all, is for Congress to pass legislation that would allow millions of working Americans to earn up to 7 days of paid sick leave per year. And that idea that workers should be able to earn paid sick leaves is one that, you know, Americans around the country really support. We saw an overwhelming number of Americans in the state of Massachusetts go to the polls to pass paid sick leave in their state, and the president believes that all Americans should have access to the right to earn paid sick leave. He's also proposing more than $2 billion in new funds to encourage states to develop paid family and medical leave programs, and announcing that the Department of Labor will use $1 million in existing funds to help states and cities conduct feasibility studies to get their own paid leave programs up and running. Right now, there are three states that already offer paid leave to new parents, and the president wants to encourage more states to consider developing such proposals. And then finally, he modernized the federal workplace by signing a presidential memorandum last week, which directed agencies to advance up to 6 weeks of paid sick leave for new parents or for parents with a new child. And he's also calling on Congress to pass legislation to give federal employees an additional 6 weeks of paid parental leave. As you may know, federal employees don't have the right to take paid maternity or paternity leave. And what this is doing is, first of all, ensuring that they can all take at least 6 weeks by using that advanced sick leave, but also asking Congress to modernize the federal workplace by providing paid parental leave.
From the standpoint of someone who is an expert on policy in this matter and others, why does the U.S. have such a problem with maternal and paternal leave when so many countries in the industrialized world seem to think it's part of sort of the cost of doing business?
Well, what I know is the good news is we've had so much experience around the world and even in parts of the U.S., adopting and expanding paid parental leave programs that we know a lot about their effects. And what the research shows clearly is that adopting these types of family-friendly policies are good for parents, are good for workers, and it's good for the economy. Businesses that adopt paid leave policies see positive results. A study of over 700 firms found that firms with work-life balance policies had higher productivity. Other policies show that it can boost corporate profits. And when California implemented paid family leave a decade ago, it's now been 10 years, they passed paid family leave in 2004, lots of employers expressed concern that requiring paid family leave would hurt their bottom line. But 6 years into the program, in 2010, 90% of employers reported that the law did not negatively affect their productivity, profitability, morale, or turnover. So I think what you have is before the policy happens, people are worried and nervous. But what we've seen in study after study is that it's easy to adapt to. People don't tend to abuse paid sick leave. That's a study that looked at paid sick days in Connecticut found that few employers reported abuse. And another really interesting study when it comes to paid sick leave pointed out that there's actually lower absenteeism when there's paid sick leave because people don't come to work sick, and that means fewer people get sick, and that actually results in people taking fewer days off, and that's one of the reasons why it's not as hurtful to businesses when they're paying sick leave than some of them might have anticipated ahead of time.
We're going to run some of those arguments by a critic of family leave policies, but before we go, Betsy, what are the limitations of the White House in mandating these kinds of policies for all workers outside of the federal workforce?
Well, I mean, what the president has said is that he is going to work with whoever he can to try to bring paid sick leave and paid family leave to all Americans. He's going to work with Congress. He's going to work with businesses to make the business case directly to them. And he's going to work with state and local governments. That's one of the reasons why he has funds in his budget to help state and local governments, because we're seeing state and local governments moving on this, even if Congress is dragging their heels.
Betsy Stevenson helped to draft President Obama's parental leave plan. She's a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors and a professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan. Thanks, Betsy.
It was great talking with you.
Joining us now with a contrary analysis is Kay Heimowitz, fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men into Boys. There's a provocative title. Welcome.
Thank you.
But on the question of family leave, what do you make of the arguments from Betsy that where it's been tried, there haven't been the anticipated negative impact?
Well, I think that I agree with actually a lot of what she said. I think that so far in California in particular, that's been studied quite a bit because it's been 10 years, there has not been a big downside that we can find. But I think what people need to understand that this is not you don't want to bring any magical thinking into this. It's not like it's going to solve the gender gap. It's not like it's going to have an enormous impact on inequality or anything like that. And it's extremely important how we choose to do this. Now, there are countries that we think of as enormously family friendly. The Nordic countries
right.
that come to mind. You've got Sweden and Norway in particular that have very, very long family leaves. And what's happened there that nobody anticipated is that, in fact, it's added to the gender wage gap. And that may be a trade-off some people are willing to make. I would, actually. But it's not going to be to everybody's taste. So that's one possible downside if you don't do it right.
Why would paid family leave programs increase the disparity between wages of men and women?
Because, as I said, it's only if it's very long.
Right.
So, for instance, in Sweden, it's over a year if you want so choose.
So you're out of the workforce.
The answer is easy. Now, at what point, what the cutoff point is, I can't tell you. All I'm saying is that a lot of what looks like, well, the more the better, doesn't turn out to be quite that way. There's also another concern that I think people need to keep in mind, which has to do with employers. And at a certain point, if an employer is looking at two possible employees, applicants, and one is a young woman, let's say 30 years old and newly married, and the other is a guy in his 40s, let's say, you could see how he might hesitate if he's going to be thinking, he or she, if he's thinking about the future of his firm.
Now, I can well imagine that, but is there any statistical basis for that prejudice?
There is not that I've seen. It would be an extremely difficult thing to study
sure.
because it's a, you'd be studying a negative, but not that I'm aware of it is, however, inevitable that if you give too many kinds of advantages or benefits to one particular group, you are going to disincentivize employers from hiring them.
I think part of the president's vision here is to equalize parental leave for men and women, but we'll see what happens as far as Congress is concerned. Is part of your argument, though, that this shouldn't be top-down, this shouldn't be federally directed, that this should be state
right.
or locally directed?
Right. I think it would be a mistake to make this a federal program. I think that each state needs to be experimenting with this. We have seen, as Betsy Stevenson said, some fairly successful experiments. They've been fairly modest by international standards, by the way, but they seem to be working well enough. I mean, there are some complaints that I've heard from in call-in shows where people say, well, I don't want to have to pay for my co-workers to be working in the to be taking time off. But I think that's probably not very widespread. And the amount of money that people put into this employee payroll tax that they pay for these programs is very, very small.
Would you say this should be worker-directed, that workers should decide how much leave they take rather than the federal government mandating 6 weeks or 7 days or make it an arbitrary number?
I don't think it can be worker-directed because the workers can't possibly understand what the downsides are for employers. And the only thing less unfriendly, family-friendly, than no family leave is unemployment.
Did you have family leave in your family?
Yeah, I was working part-time and was able and teaching so that I was able to do that, yeah.
And as far as family leave policies are concerned, are there benefits one way or another, since you've written so much on children, to kids for family leave programs or to not have family leave programs?
Yeah, there's some evidence that mothers who take family leave are more likely to breastfeed and to breastfeed for longer. So, yes, there could be advantages, and there does seem to have been that result in California.
Thinking about the family leave proposals of the president in tonight's State of the Union address, Kay Heimowitz is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men into Boys. Thanks so much, Kay.
Thank you.
We'll give the last words in this debate to you, Nancy in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I would love this, but what are we parents being paid for, and why would an employer have to bear that expense? While employees might be happier as a result of being paid to be on leave, the employer really gets nothing productive out of it.
Hi, this is Nathan in Bradenton, Florida. And yes, I think parental leave should be right, because women losing jobs or promotions to become mothers is one of the chief causes of the income gap in this country. Women should not be financially punished for choosing to become mothers or have to give up on their other dreams. And both sexes should be able to take this leave time for a new baby. Stay-at-home dads are important too. American parental leave is far too meager. If we are really a pro-family country, we should act like it.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. The U.S. Department of Agriculture was established back in 1862 by Abraham Lincoln to help farmers in what was then the industry central to the U.S. economy, farming. If you go to the New York Times today, it seems that animals in U.S. agriculture could use some emancipation. An investigation into a federally run research facility shows a pattern of abuse of animals in the pursuit of higher production, something way beyond the expectations of modern industrial farming. The U.S. Meat Animal Research Center in Clay County, Nebraska, according to investigative reporter Michael Moss, reveals a pitiful and ruthless relationship between U.S. agriculture and the traditional creatures of the farm.
This center was created 50 years ago to be the world prestigious place to re-engineer farm animals to meet the growing demand for meat in the world and also to increase profits for the meat industry. And the way they go about that is to re-engineer farm animals through surgery, breeding, other techniques to make them more productive. This is the place that has been striving to make pork chops leaner, lamb chops bigger, beef more chewable, and all of that would be fine, except there have been some complications.
Well, one of the complications with lamb is they've attempted to take utterly domesticated lamb and try to re-engineer them to live in the wild with results that are just terrifying. Describe, first of all, what the mission is and what they've discovered as they've put these lambs out to pasture.
Right. So for the past 10 years and to continue for another 4 years, they've had a project called the Easy Care Project. So they are taking lambs that have hair, for example, instead of wool to eliminate the cost of shearing the animals if hair falls out on its own. They have breeds that are giving triplets instead of the ordinary one or two because more babies means more meat and more profits. And then finally, they're taking these lambs and having them, as you pointed out, give birth out in the pastures instead of the warm, cozy barns that sheep farmers normally do in order to drive down the labor cost. And the result is horrific from farm standpoint. I managed to gain access to the facility, to the lambing project, in the height of the lambing season in May, when they were pulling a dozen or more ragdoll bodies off the pasture, bringing them for necropsy to figure out why they died. And they had typically died of starvation because their mothers had rejected them, exposure to the weather, because this is Nebraska after all, and there's wild weather in May, and these lambs have gotten wet and cold, and predation. There were five of them that were chewed up by coyotes because they're out there in the pasture, and they have some guard dogs to help out, but the guard dogs are not entirely effective.
So cruelty to the lambs and a design that seems misguided. It's not possibly going to work.
You know, they would argue it's not cruelty. They would argue that this is a trade-off in their overall mission to feed the world's growing population and deliver red meat, lamb, pork, and beef to 9 billion people in the world. And as they say, they care about animal welfare. The scientists there say they're doing their best, but there are some trade-offs if that's how you want to feed the world.
Would they use this trade-off language to explain why in libido experiments for bulls, that bulls were left to mount a cow for hours to the point where she just was dead?
I think some of the issue in this place is that there is a holdover from the days when very few people felt that farm animals had real feelings or even felt pain. And you have to remember, too, that the Animal Welfare Act that was passed back in 1964 that cracked down on the use of animals, especially dogs and cats in laboratories, had a huge gaping loophole in it. It exempted farm animals that are used for experimentation. And so there was this lingering attitude out there that animals, farm animals, don't feel like other people or other animals or certainly people do. There's another case where they were extracting lung tissue from a pig and it should have been dead, but it wasn't. And the pig was gagging and thrashing around on the table. And the scientist who was in charge of having euthanized it, it didn't work, seemed to almost take some pleasure in the matter, to the horror of the scientist who was trying to get the DNA tissue, RNA tissues.
Who's responsible for this facility and who's driving this level of experimentation here?
It's part of the Department of Agriculture out of Washington, but they have largely deferred the specifics of how the scientists in the facility will use the animals in their experiments to those scientists. And those scientists and the center itself has resisted interest in having it become scrutinized, accredited by outside organizations. On the other side, the industry itself has sort of been repelled by and been unmoved by some of the experimental results. Because, look, ranchers are people too, and they care about their animals. And I'm thinking offhand about the twinning project in the cows, trying to get cows to have twins instead of the normal one. And they were coming out, you know, where their legs were getting tangled, and in females, the genitals were getting deformed, and the death rate was so much higher that the industry itself was saying, I don't think we want this. And yet the center, in its zeal to sort of accomplish its mission, just kept going and kept going and kept going.
What changes here? How does this change? Do they have to be more closely regulated?
So the veterinarian scientist who came to me with concern is hoping that at the minimum this center gets oversight from external groups who can actually help them design even better experience. Not to mention protect the animal welfare more. But this other disconnect that's happening out there, because increasingly consumers are caring more and more about how the animals are treated that they are eating. Animal welfare is becoming a huge thing. And the biggest companies are responding to that, so that recently Tyson issued an order to its suppliers to better protect the pigs. And Whole Foods now has standards on animal welfare for its fresh meat. And so increasingly, there's been a gap between this center's drive to increase production and seemingly the rest of the country kind of going the other direction and caring less about production and more about the welfare and the safety and the well-being of these animals.
Michael Moss is an author and investigative reporter. You can read his investigation into the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center in today's New York Times.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
It's a statistical anomaly for social scientists. It's a national embarrassment for every American. And it's a daily struggle for classroom teachers. A study by the Southern Education Foundation says that because of economic and demographic trends, for the first time in at least 50 years, more than half of all U.S. public school students come from low-income families. Now, we shouldn't need such a statistic to construct a headline about public education and poverty that is a daily reality for so many teachers. So we have a pair of teachers here with us. Larry Ferlazzo is an English and social studies teacher at Luther Burbank High School in Sacramento, California. And Joy DePalme is a sixth grade teacher at the Boston Teachers Union Pilot School. Joy, how many of your students would you say fall into this category of being in poverty?
I would say anywhere from 25 to 30%.
And what does that mean to your day-to-day classroom operations?
I feel like they need to feel like they're in a safe space. I also make sure that I take into account, even when I give homework assignments, I don't hit them with homework assignments in large amounts at the beginning of the week because I don't know what they're coming off of from the weekend.
Larry Ferlazzo, does that sound familiar to you?
Yes. I mean, our school is 100% free lunch, and there are a lot of challenges that brings to the classroom.
Can you tell me the story of an individual student, without using their name, who you felt might be slipping behind, that you weren't able to reach given all of the swirl and turmoil that was happening around them, Larry?
There are many students who I wish I had been able to reach a little bit more. And many students just disappear, and move, and I don't know what ends up happening with them. I mean, I just think it's important to recognize that, though our students are living in a low-income situation, they are just as intelligent and have as much potential as anyone else.
Joy?
I'm thinking about a particular student, and the student, they came to my class, mid-year, and couldn't really communicate verbally in English. Some of the kids did try to, support the student and so forth. But at the end of the day, because he was living in a shelter, it was difficult for him to get back and forth to school. He was being shuttled from another county. And when the school year started up again, I just didn't see him. And it was just a struggle to try to keep him on track when he's showing up, 10 o'clock and school starts at 8:15 and he might not have eaten breakfast. And, you can't really have a conference with the parents because when they're brought in, the parents aren't allowed to use the transportation with them. It's the child only. It was madness. And I felt really bad. And when coming back this year, I was hoping that he would still be in the school and possibly, his family would have found decent housing, but that wasn't the case. And to this day, I have no idea where he is.
Larry, would you say that the proliferation of students who are in poverty in the classroom transforms the school into a social service agency as well as an educational facility?
Yeah, well, yes, certainly as a major institution in our students' lives and their students having so many needs, that's one of the things that we have to act as.
Is that a welcome responsibility or does that get in the way of education?
I think it's just the reality. I mean, I think two things that we teachers have to keep in mind in that situation are, one, the fact that so many researchers have found that teachers anywhere can only impact 10 to 30% of factors that influence academic performance. And we just have to be aware that our students' outside experience affect what's happening in the classroom. And researchers have found that we all have what's called sort of the brain's bandwidth, that when we concentrate on one thing, we can't pay as much attention to others. And when you can't, when you're not sure if your family's going to get evicted, or if, you know, you walk to school and it's raining and your parents can't afford gas money to bring dry clothes to your to you back at school, that's going to affect how students are in the classroom.
We're talking to Larry Ferlazzo, who's a teacher in Sacramento, California. Joy DePalm is in Boston, Massachusetts. Larry was talking about awareness on the part of teachers of the social condition of students in the school. How aware, since your classroom is integrated, how aware are the middle-class students of the social conditions of the 20% that you spoke about earlier, Joy?
I don't think they have a clue unless they actually have a relationship with a particular student. Particularly this year, how they interact with each other is really on a surface level when they become really close, which is it's about that time of the year when it starts to happen. Students start to share their stories about, you know, what they've gone through and what they've experienced. But initially, I would say they're really not clear on, you know, the day-to-day struggles of some of the students in the classroom.
What's it like when two students become aware that they live in two different worlds, Joy?
They're at this age, 11, 12, 13, where the personal stuff, they don't necessarily share with the teacher. I know that when I have discussions with students and I let them know that I'm aware of their situation, they're appreciative when I explain to them that there are certain concessions and certain things we're going to do differently, hopefully with the same outcome, because I understand what their current situation is.
To both of you, how do you think poverty impedes education for Americans who are learning this statistic that over half of students are in poverty in the United States? Larry?
Well, I think it just creates many, many more challenges for our students to learn.
And in your case, Joy?
I wouldn't say that it would impede, because I've actually worked with students who have had far less and a greater percentage of students who are in poverty than I'm dealing with now. I have a job to do and I have to get it done. And these kids are entitled to an education.
Joy DePalm, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Joy DePalm is a sixth grade teacher at the Boston Teachers Union Pilot School in Boston, Massachusetts. And Larry Ferlazzo, thanks so much to you.
And thank you for the invitation.
Larry Ferlazzo is an English and social studies teacher at Luther Burbank High School in Sacramento, California. The grim truth about what is happening in Syria is an everyday story of war and chaos that is still sometimes hard to believe. Hardest, perhaps, for the people who watched it happen.
For us as Syrians, we can't believe what's happening to our country. This is not the Syria that we know. And so it's very surreal, and we're in shock. And I think even if you ask us 10 years from now, we're going to still be in shock.
Hani El-Sayed has reported the truth of the civil war in Syria, the 200,000 lives lost and the millions more displaced. She has also reported a government-approved and tidied-up version of the story when she was host of the most popular morning radio program in Damascus, Good Morning Syria. Hani El-Sayed left her country 3 years ago and is now based in Washington, D.C., co-founder of an exile broadcast channel with internet contributors all over the world called Suriali.
Suriali has a double meaning. Surya Li means Syria is mine. And as you would understand, it's not for anybody. It's not for a family. It's not for a government. It's for the people. It's for me.
The story of Hani El-Sayed and Suri Ali is a story of media and truth. El-Sayed and her colleagues broadcast the unvarnished truth into Syria, supplemented by a new popular soap opera series called We Are All Refugees. El-Sayed has no fancy studio anymore, but she has discovered a new power in free, renegade media.
I began over a decade ago doing radio, and it was a number one show for 10 years consecutive as a morning show. It had over 6 million listeners. I was in a studio like I am today here. But now we're a team of almost 23 people, and we're all Syrians. We're 50% women, and that's on purpose. We're in Europe. We're in the Middle East. There's only two of us in the United States. Our objective here is peace building and community building. And the way we're working from outside is basically now I have a microphone and a laptop, and I do it from my desk right next to my window. And if I have an interview, which I run over Skype, I go into my closet. So yes, it is different. But the biggest difference is I can say what I want.
Let's talk about what it was like on that job site. What was the name of your show?
Good Morning Syria. And it was in modern classical Arabic. And then I come and I speak in my dialect. I'm bilingual. I throw in English. I put English music with Arabic music. And I start a dialogue in that sense. It's interactive. I have people calling in, people texting. I'm personal on the show. I come from American institutions too. So there's a Western side to that that was introduced. And it was a side that made a hit.
And that directness was what really attracted the attention.
So I did poke fun on, I was doing my ID this morning, and guess what? Of course he wanted money. How else am I going to do my ID? And then I just throw things like that, and then I go on with the show. It's a 3-hour show. But within that 3-hour show, I had campaigns like I Am Syrian. And the I Am Syrian campaign went on for actually 2 years. So I was like indirectly trying to create, you know, civil change by the time we figure out how do you change, the politics. And if you can't reform civilly and culturally and socially, you'll never know what kind of politics you really need. What's the next person you want to elect? So the platform needs to also be there. And it was going pretty well. Of course, I wanted more of a green light. But a year after the show started, I actually had the administration call me in and say, you have a green light. But I knew that that green light meant as long as I don't do X, Y, and Z. And I took it and I went with it. But in 2011, when the uprising started, that green light was completely red. And everything turned political and everything turned in-your-face propaganda machine of this is what you need to say and you need to invite people to go down to the marches and you need to. And then it's not easy at that point to say, I'm leaving. You can't have so many followers and say, I'm leaving.
How did you decide? How did you come to the conclusion that you had to get out?
I wanted to get out in April of 2011. And you know, a lot of people say, you're crazy, don't do it. You know, wait a minute. You know how everybody was saying 2 more months, it's going to finish, It was that either 2 weeks or 2 more months. For some reason, that was the myth. And in my heart, I knew that that's it. This is not 2 more months because the reaction was violent. And when the reaction is violent and nobody's going to come to your help, then God knows what's going to happen next. So I said, fine, let me wait. Let me see. Maybe I can still use my platform somehow. And that was, of course, impossible. And it was a moral dilemma again for me, professionally and personally on an ethics and value. I just felt it's impossible. But how do I leave? Where do I go? You ask yourself 100 questions. You've built all of this, and then now you don't know where you're going. I'm supposed to be able to at least read a text message from Hamas and say what it says and not be worried about that, the consequences of that. I should not have to say that the peaceful protests that are taking place are terrorists. They were not terrorists. These were peaceful people.
So what did you decide to do?
I decided to leave, and of course I couldn't tell anybody that I was leaving. And I just basically what happened is I think it was the day before New Year's Eve where I said on the show that, you know, I'm leaving for 2 months for media training and I'll be back, knowing that I will not be back. I sold everything that I have. I had a visa to the United States. I left through the airport. I just did it in a smart way.
What was it like to start another media platform? Because you couldn't really say goodbye to media.
You couldn't say goodbye to anything, not just media. It's a whole life. And I am extremely lucky. So sometimes when media, you know, they ask, you know, tell us your story, I feel like my story is nothing. When I see the refugees, these people have stories. And they live in the most dire situations in the tents and the camps. At least I had people that hosted me until I was able to stand on my feet again. And I've been lucky throughout. Not everybody had that opportunity and chance, and that is even more limited today. There's not a country today, even in the region, that Lebanon and so on. These are countries that we didn't need visas. Now we need visas. So it's an issue, to be honest, because every Syrian outside Syria feels extremely guilty. We wanted to do something, and we all came from different backgrounds. And we got together and we said, fine, you know, this is a platform that we need to have. And like I said, it's a platform that grew. It was hours and days on Skype because we live in, you know, different continents. But we were very determined, very persistent. And that's how we started Suriali as a project. And we also have a youth magazine that we print and try to distribute in refugee camps and inside Syria, too.
Hani El-Sayed is host, producer, and co-founder of Radio Suriali. Tomorrow we will talk about how Suriali has helped create a soap opera series about life in wartime.
لك يا أهلا وسهلا إن شاء الله عجبك الأكل سيد رامي عجبك الأكل
والله يخلف يخلف يا أخوي يا فادي أي شو هذا يا زلمة أي كثير زاكي بصراحة
صحة وهنا
والله أسكم من كنت أتوقع يا زلمة شو هذا
مي صحة وهنا
والله أنتو سوري اللي
We are all refugees a fictional series trying to get at the truth about the war in Syria and the crisis for millions of refugees That's tomorrow on The Takeaway If you want to react to that or respond to anything you heard on today's program, call us at 877-8-BY-TAKE, send us a tweet at The Takeaway, or go to thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.